You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM. And welcome back for part two of the Batuta Advocate's interview with Spanion. You're joined by myself, Clancy Overall, and of course, Errol Parker, editor-at-large of the Batuta Advocate. In this episode, we'll be talking to Spanion about jail, not necessarily boys' home. We're talking about the big house here and everything that came, including his descent into, or ascent, depends which way you want to look at it, into organized crime before the big sting that landed him in jail for his longest stretch and his redemption from there. As Spanion would say, let's oh gaze. So I want to kind of talk about that journey into, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, leaving juvie into, you know, up there with the big boys. You write, you know, your first kind of place you stayed, you actually didn't mind the food and the clothes they gave you and the sneakers that they gave you as, you know, your first trial at juvie.
Juvie, it was good, yeah.
At juvie. Yeah. And then where did you find, you went to a lot of different jails around New South Wales. Where was the worst?
To say the worst, everything is the best and worst in its own respect, but funny enough, probably the worst jail to be at is the jail I've done most of my time at, and that would be Bathurst.
Yeah.
It was seen as a punishment wing.
Yeah.
Jails are built in generations, and they're all built on blueprints of each other. So not every jail is an individual jail.
Yeah.
They're blueprinted off each other, and they'll build like four at a time, you know? And the original outlay of jails was the old dungeon type jail, and that was built in the 19th century, and that was jails like Long Bay, Maitland, Parramatta, Goulburn, and Bathurst.
Yeah.
So if you go to those jails are like,
they feel similar.
Yeah, they're almost blueprints of each other.
Yeah,
like
even
from bird's eye views, the cells are the same, everything.
Yeah.
So those jails are, it's a full dungeon. There is no showers in your cell. There is no windows that close. The windows are open. Mm-hmm. It's barred. So if you're in jail, I've done like four winters in a row in
Bathurst
jail.
No window.
So at the your back wall, up say the top of your arm height, so you'd have to jump up to look out.
Yeah.
There is a window. It's a pretty big window. It is probably about a meter wide, probably about 60 centimeters high. And what stops you getting out is just three thick bars that make it impossible to fit anything through. But there is complete exposure.
It gets proper cold in Bathurst,
proper
doesn't
cold.
It?
It gets so cold. It gets so cold that at least 4 months a year when you walk out in the morning, because you get let out. And say this is two with the daily routine of Bathurst to add it on top of, and the summers are ridiculous.
Yeah.
To add this, the daily routine about this is you get up at, used to be like this, you get up at 7 a.m. and you've got half an hour in the wing, and that's your shower time. That's the time you've got to clean your cell and do absolutely everything. Use a microwave if you can fit in line. And then you're out at 7:30 into the yard, which is, it's a triangle-shaped yard that has nothing but concrete, no grass, no dirt, no nothing. One corner is a toilet and one phone. One corner is a chin-up bar and a dip bar. That's it. There's no seats in the yard. There's no nothing.
Nothing green, no grass.
No green, no grass, no nothing. So, and into that yard pours two different wings. Mm-hmm. Each wing, 64 people. So there's 120 people in this yard. And you just find your place on the concrete. And you sit there, and that's it. And you sit there, and to line up for the phone, it's like maybe a two-hour thing.
Yeah.
So you put a knock-in. It's called a knock-in. Not all jails are like this.
Yeah.
This is why I'm explaining why Bathurst is the worst. You put a knock-in, and you might be like 13th or 14th in line on the phone. There's a lot of arguments, people getting ahead. It's actually one of the highest tension points is lining up for the phone in the whole jail system. It's probably more fights over the phone. It would only be second to drugs in jail.
Yeah.
And that's you're in that yard until 2:45, and then you've got 15 minutes in back in the wing to have a shower. There's four showers, 64 inmates. The hot water goes for about 5 minutes. So legit, there's four showers. This is crazy. All right, there's four shower heads. Each shower, it's a normal thing to cycle. So each shower would have four people under it at once. I'm not talking no big, powerful shower head. I'm talking like the worst house you can rent, $240
roadside
a week.
Roadside motel.
Yes, that shower head, like it's small. And so there's four of yous that rotate in each shower so that way 16 people can shower at once, all right? And you rotate like in whatever direction, and you each get about like 10, 10 seconds under the water. And while you're rotating, so imagine like four positions and then bang, you're under. And then you're left, back, right, under. And you're soaping up and cleaning yourself. And then bang, and you've got your 10 seconds, rinse it off. And you do another round because you haven't washed properly. You do like 3-4 rounds and then like the next four are in. And that's how bad it was. I've had showers, so many showers, where I didn't get back to the temperature because you said how cold it is there. When you come out 4 months a year into the yard at Bathurst, the taps don't work. Yeah. And there will be, in the lowest point of the concrete where the water would gather, sheets of ice that you could like pick up, shatter on the floor and like stab someone with it. It's proper cold there. It's proper cold. You could ice skate in the mornings. That's your life at Bathurst. That I've done years in a row like that.
I want to talk about in that yard, you mentioned at the start, you know, you nationality, people break off into that and your background and you know, you as the, you know, Spaniard with your mate, the Colombian. But you spend a lot of time, and you can you read this in the book, you spend a lot of time around the Couries, Redfern, Woolloomooloo, Glebe. I want you to explain to the listeners right now, because it's a term I'd never heard of before, and I have good reason, because I've never been incarcerated in New South Wales, the term magpie. Explain what that is, because that's an interesting archetype you've introduced me to.
Yeah, sweet. So in jail, the biggest ways to get protection is to be part of the one of the four biggest majorities. And that is the Aboriginals, the some people call them the Lebos, but it's more the Muslims, all right, because anyone can be part of it. So there's the Muslims, the Kuris, the Islanders, and the Asians. If you want to be part of it, if you want to be sort of safe, doesn't mean you're safe. You don't walk around and do what you want. I've seen 100 Lebos, 100 Kuris, 100 Islanders get chopped. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean anything. It comes and goes. If you're part of it, then you have to, there's sometimes you might just be bashed for hanging around them. So in some ways it's worse. But anyway, back to the point is that magpie is people who are absolutely not Aboriginal in any sense. And I'm not talking people like who are, I'm not talking fair-skinned Kuris, which there are plenty, and there's like a lot of historical reasons that exists. I'm talking people that are legitimately white, pretending they're Aboriginal. That's what a magpie is.
You said some people take it quite far with the tattoos and the
face. So the best way, you know, you can tell by the effort someone puts in that they're trying to make up for something. So you'll see a Kuri bloke will just be himself. Then you see even a fair-skinned Kuri. And just them, you can say the way they talk, the way they hold themselves. You know they're Aboriginal. You know where they've grown up and this and that. When you see a white person attempting to be Aboriginal, they have every visual iconic thing that they can have. So they got a tattoo on their hand of the Aboriginal flag. They've made themselves out of dental floss and red, yellow, and black beads, a necklace, rings, bracelets, like anklets that are all in the Aboriginal beads. So when you look, you can't mistake them. They will they'll get a text down, they'll draw the Aboriginal flag on their shirt. That's the end. And then you just know. You look at them like, bro, relax.
How did you do get away with it, you know, growing up with all the Kuris, sitting with the Kuris? How did you get away with not being put on the magpie?
Oh, because I never said I was Aboriginal. Being a magpie is pretending you're Aboriginal. Being a magpie isn't a white person that hangs around an Aboriginal. It's pretending you're Aboriginal. So that's very two completely different things. So me, it was just completely natural. All of my friends except for the younger friends, the couple that I'm from an area where it's all Aboriginals. Everything I learned, my mannerisms, the slang that I use, were all learnt off Kuris. All of my girlfriends throughout my teenage years, early 20s, were Aboriginal. My first son is Aboriginal. Everything about me other than my blood was Aboriginal, right? And I'm saying that from the streets. So when I go to jail, I may look like a Muslim or like Lebanese, and a lot of times the Lebos or Turks would come up to me and thinking I'm like, hey, look, thinking I'm one of them. And they'll hear two words come out of my mouth and they'd look at each other like, why does he talk like that? You know what I mean? So anyway, like it was just back to, like all jokes aside, it's completely natural. Like I'm in jail with my best friends. My co-offenders that I get locked up with are Aboriginal. So like I'm in jail with the boys from my area, the boys that are who are in my crew, YWB, my searching crew, they're all Kuri. How can I not hang around Kuris? And at the start, it was not like I was accepted as
a
Kuri.
Was it testy? Like, did it ever get a bit funny with all the other guys you didn't grow up with?
So Around anyone from the city? No.
Yeah.
It was that's Spanian. Yeah. He's one
I did,
of
I
us.
I read you had a bit of trouble in Grafton.
In Kempsey.
In Kempsey.
So one of the during my first adult sentence, I went to Kempsey.
Yeah.
Then I'm with, because you've got to understand, even in the Aboriginal community in jail, not all couriers are like best friends.
Mm. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Families,
like,
your towns,
like even amongst the islanders, like there's Samoans fight with the Tongans, even amongst, we all know, like the Lebos, they all kill each other all the time. You know what I mean? So it doesn't mean just because you're couri that just like every couri is going to love you or be hanging around couris. So not only am I actually not Aboriginal, but I'm like seen as one of the Red Fern Woolow boys, like a couri boys, you know what I mean? But then I'm in jail with all the Kempsey couries from the mission up there. And you know what I mean? So it's like, man, he's from Red. But anyway, having said that, I was still accepted like pretty well. Like the young lads from all the rural areas, so the young lads from the missions at like Dubbo and Kempsey and all the famous areas out
Moree.
There. And Moree and stuff.
Yeah.
They were all like, as soon as they knew, they were, where are you from, bro? I said, Woolow, Red Fern. Okay, come on, bro, let's go. Like I'm with them.
Yeah.
But what you're referring to is... the elders are a bit different, right? The elders, for their own experiences, and rightfully so, maybe, maybe not. They see people of any other race attempting to have anything to do more with them than what already happened to them as just, it's just the hatred, hatred. Yeah. Like there would be, like, so one day I remember, like, the elders, one of the elders, I think he was from, it was in Kempsey Jail, but I actually think the elder, the uncle we call him, I think he was from... Will Kenya.
Way out back.
These people live in the red dirt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he looked at, like he's seen the young brothers, which is what the couriers are called, the brothers. So the uncle's seen the young brothers sitting with someone that looks like a Lebo, right? I look like a Lebo or a Turk or something like that. And he's walked up. He's like, what's... And you got to understand at this time too, so this is 2003 or four, this is very racial system. Now it's not. Now no one cares. Now in jail, I think it's like jail gangs. It's not a race thing anymore. It's like, I joined this gang before it was your Nasho. And you're talking, say, back then, the Lebos and the Kuris were fighting.
Yeah.
He walked up, he's seen a Lebo-looking person sitting with the young brothers and going, what are you sitting with this cunt?
Yeah.
This white cunt, like that. And they're like, "Unc, he's one of the boys. He's from Redfern. No, fuck this white land grab and can't get this putrid cunt away from us." Like, that's how they said it to him.
Yeah.
I'm 18 years old in Kempsey, a jail where it's just full couries. One of the elders, who I later found out is a violent person in jail, he's like telling them, "Fuck this, can put me on the thing." So they just like, if he said to them, "You just need to bash him," they would have done it. But he didn't say that. He just said, "Why are you hanging around this putrid land grab and white, whatever you put me on, everything under the sun." And so they just put their head down, and like, I put my head down, he walked off, swearing at himself. And then they all looked at each other and they go, "Don't worry about him, he's just an angry cunt." And I was like, that was like the legitimately the first time that I was ever like scared in jail. Like scared something was going to happen to me. Like I thought something was going to happen to me just for my race. You know what I mean? But that was the only experience I ever had like that. It was only a sentence or two. By the time I was 20, 21 years old, I'd spent that entire time in jail too. Like 18, 19, 20, 21, 20, the whole time's in jail. By the time I was 21, I was a couri. Like I was an honorary couri. Like I was, there would even be, like in the last sentence I was in. Like,
oh, we even see it on your podcast, all your guests, all your mates that you grew up with. And
it could come to my later years of jail that like I would go to a yard and I would be one of them. I'm not saying I'm couri. No one get it wrong to say I'm pretending I'm couri, but that's my crew. I would be one of the main boys of the couris. Like I would have younger brothers that are looking up to me. Like I'm the older couri.
You know
what I mean? And like the old, other Lebos would, if there was an issue with couris, would, or islanders or something, would come and say something to me. Like, "Bro, what's going on with that young couri, bro? Tell him something because he's talking shit to that island," you know, and I'd say something, bro. So it got that, but I was completely accepted, except for that one time,
Except for in a particularly hairy kind of situation. When your last release was...
2017, wasn't it?
2017.
Yeah, 2017.
And in your book, it reads like you're finding different mindsets as you go. You get off the gear, you know, that's the first thing. You get off the gear, you're still involved in crime. And then, and in fact, in that point, when you're off the gear, it becomes a little less pointless and street, like, feed myself. It becomes a bit more organized.
Yeah. and becomes worse.
Yeah, it becomes worse in bigger sentences.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the cross kind of comes, plays a bigger role in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell us in that parcel, you know, of time in your life where you're off the gear, you're not, there's nothing. Obviously, after all that incarceration and all that time in, you know, certain suburbs, and you pick up addictions and you were using. And it's quite honest about it in your book. But then you were clean, and all of a sudden you got cash and lots of it, and you know the area well enough to run a proper operation.
Yep.
What were you doing? What was happening? How much money were you making? Can you tell us?
Oh, so the time you're talking about is when I got out in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that point, that was the longest time I spent out of jail in my life. Mm-hmm. I spent 10 months out of jail, and I'd never done that before. I think my previous record before that was 4 months.
Right.
So I'd spent 10 months out of that time, and I was on a complete mission to live to the extreme, the other side of crime, the other side of crime. So like being young, I went from a violent, let's have fun criminal.
Mm.
Bash anyone, stab anyone, steal everything, get drunk, smash cars. Mm. Then it went to drug addiction. It was like live in the shadows, steal everything, use drugs and hang out and just rubbish, like sad crime, right? That was where a lot of my sneaky crimes come into it. In a way, it was good, right? In a way, it was good. Like being a heroin addict definitely makes you less violent.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's good. If I had no other choice but to be a criminal in the street, which was the mindset and was going to happen regardless, heroin was like the damper on that. You know what I mean? So it probably saved me a lot from like killing people and stuff like that. You know what I mean? But anyway, after that, I'd lived like that heroin addict. So in hindsight, it wasn't actually very long, because now when I think of the boys I grew up with who are nearly all on heroin till today, they've been on heroin for 20 something years.
Yeah.
So I got on heroin when I was a teenager and jumped off when I was 20.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
You know what I mean? So, like, and to be honest with them, but I was injecting as a teenager, ejecting a lot.
Yeah.
When in the small pockets, in that 3-4 year period where I was on the gear in the streets, I was probably only on in the streets, like I said, 2 months here, 3 months here. So to be completely honest, if you look back over a 4 year period, probably 8 of those months I was actually in the streets, a heroin addict.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I did do it to the extreme. Back to the point, I wanted to live to the other side. Like, I was always stealing everything and selling it to someone, and someone's taking my money and taking my goods and this and that. And, you know, and I just made it a mission that I'm going to do everything that you would visualize a successful criminal to do. Like, you know, like a cool criminal, muscly and tattoos and nice cars and jewelry. So that was my mission. And I achieved that very well. So I got out 2011. With straight away the mission from the day I got out and I started organizing it that day was to sell heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was to be that person.
So your mind just changed. You've got all this heroin around you. You have no thoughts of doing it.
No, not at all. So I got off heroin in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So 4 years, I'd already been off heroin for 4 years at this point. But the first time I got out, so I got off 2007. I got out in 2008 and had the intentions of becoming a drug dealer now.
Yeah.
But the day I got out, I stabbed someone.
Yeah.
All right. So that put that on hold for 3 years.
Yeah.
So now I had to do another 3 years. I was only out for 6 days, I think.
Yeah.
Stabbed someone. Then I was hiding under people's beds for 6 days and got done. Anyway, so that was my holiday out. 3 years later, I got out round two. And I said to myself, like, there can't be any more stabbings. Because I forgot that when you're not on the heroin, you're a lot more, well, not everyone. When I'm not on the heroin, it's a lot more likely to stab someone.
Yeah.
So when I got out last time on the gear, I'm thinking I'm going to go shoot up gear, this and that. No one's getting stabbed.
Yeah.
But now, like, I'm more healthy. That's it. I'm going to take over the streets. The first person that said someone got stabbed in the neck.
Yeah.
And then so I had to remember next time, it's like, all right, now use all that energy in a good way.
Mm.
So I did. So I said to myself, no violence. I got out, started selling the gear very successfully. Took me about a 4 month period to build it up from where I wouldn't sell a single point a night, I wouldn't make $50, to the point where it was 25, 26, 27 grand getting pulled in every 24 hours with me not lifting. Me not, not only, I had numerous people like employed for me.
Yeah.
Not only wouldn't I see drugs, I wouldn't answer a call, I wouldn't see a single customer. I even had somebody to count and move my money for me.
Yeah, right.
So, like, I was living a life that was completely absent to my drug run by the end of it. And it sounds like a lot of money.
What were you driving? What were you driving?
Oh, nothing. I didn't have a license. I didn't even have an ID. I owned three cars. I had
you couldn't drive them.
Yeah, no, I couldn't drive them. I had two motorbikes as well. I had a Ducati, I had a GSXR, I had a Rexy Commodore. And my favorite car that I bought was a Typhoon, FPV a turbo type. It was like a race car. I bought it off some punhead, tuned it up. I don't know nothing about cars. He was excited. I went there. I had like 52 grand in a garbage bag. And I went to like old Wentworthville, the suburb was called. And he's like, it was like some Italian bloke. And I was like, his baby. And he's going, I've done this, I've done that. He's showing me. I go, I'm like, I'm just standing there listening. And I was like, I don't care, bro. And it's like, kid, you want the money? He goes, what's that? And I said, that's the car. He goes, you can pay me like that. Like, I said, bro, I don't want to hear it. Just, can I have the car or not?
In a plastic bag.
Yeah, in a plastic bag. And then so it's my missus at the time.
Where's this come from?
Yeah, man. My missus at the time had to drive her back because I wasn't taking no risks.
I'm
making all this money with my criminal record being on parole at the same time. If I got done for drive while unlicensed, I'm going back to jail for 2 years. I will not drive. There's no way. Imagine having
so
a
driver. So you just owned it to own it, really?
Yeah, because that was part of it.
Like,
how can I achieve what I wanted to achieve without having nice cars?
Yeah.
And so, it's also getting a lot of hot cash off your hands too, I guess.
True.
And so what are you doing in the day? You said you don't even have to pick up a finger at this point. You're not even counting money. You're just the guy whose idea and you're just, well, you mean obviously keeping an eye on it. But what are you doing during the day?
Oh, so towards the end when it was at its highest point, I would wake up, get a feed.
Because this is like in the movie where the montage is happening where they're actually looking at you and the cops are getting close.
Yeah.
Like so House of the Rising Sun's playing. And
that's it. My daily routine would be wake up, get a feed. I was living at Bondi Junction this time. I moved from the cross because it just got too out of control. Get a feed, go to Anytime Fitness. I would most days contribute to my tattoos. So I'd go contribute to my tattoos most days. Nearly every day I was in there. So painful for me. I do like 30-minute bursts, like legit. After 30 minutes, I'm crying. So we'll do a few lines and then we'll come back tomorrow. But so I build a sleeve over like 45 sessions. And then I would eat summer again. I'll spend a lot of time in what we will call massage parlors, eating the most expensive food I can find, shopping all the time. I had an obsession with jewelry and diamonds. I used to wear a lot of chains and jewelry was a big thing to me. At one time, say at that time, I was walking around with a Britling Mont Brilliant Navitimer that I had diamonds put custom into. I had like a almost 30 grand diamond bracelet. I had four chains on. One of them was custom made and it hung down to my nuts. It was 126 or 132, something like that. Forgive me, this is 10 years ago. If you unclip it, it was 130, roughly 130 centimeters long.
Yeah.
So when I clipped it, it hung to my nuts. It was all 18 karat white gold, diamonds in my face. I had diamonds put
in things. How much is it worth?
The chain?
Yeah.
I think it was 16 grand on desire, 16 grand on payment, I think.
Yeah.
32 grand that chain. And I had a couple other expensive chains on. I had diamonds, for example, I had diamonds put into one of my Gant jackets. So I had a collar, it had like diamonds in it, like the disco era. Real diamonds, but like proper diamonds, yeah.
So after your whole life to this day, what inspired you to get on the social media after all of this?
Straight out, this is something that just come about, like, to be honest. So
that era we're talking about of the glory days, Bondi Junction, that ends with a proper sting.
Oh, so there was a proper sting, a task force.
Yeah.
I was under investigation for, I think it was like 30 days, stacks of phone records, photos of me everywhere.
Yeah.
Well and truly done.
Yeah.
Well and truly done. Yeah. We weren't exactly secret. I felt like people asked me why was I would speak on the phone.
Yeah.
It was no codes. I just didn't care. And I can understand how people from normal people, civilians who jail's a scary thing. It's like everything under the sun to not get caught. Don't talk on the phone. Give you a wink and touch your nose. Stuff.
Yeah.
For me, like, I'm used to like jumping people's counters and kicking people's windows in and so to talk on a phone is nothing. I'm not talking in code.
Yeah.
Take me to jail. That's my
home. But you do have a code. The Woolo boys did have a code.
Oh, we have a code.
Can you give us a little sample of that?
Alistazi, a lad bazimala ad kazwe, a laula kazimala akistrazi. And I just basically said, this is my code, and we call it Strachey.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
You weren't even using that on the phone.
No, I wasn't even using that. I just couldn't be bothered. Like, you got to understand, I know it's like, it is stupid in hindsight, but it just goes to show that the mentality, the jail wasn't a thing to me.
Yeah.
It wasn't a thing. Like, that's my home. I was out for 10 months at that time, and I was like, how am I even out? Like, what am I doing out here?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sick
of... Institutionalised, you reckon?
Yeah, I'm sick, maybe. I'm sick of these massage parlours. Yeah, yeah. I got enough tattoos. Like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Like, up at that point, so... That was when I was 25, 26 or something. I had never, until this day, worked a single job.
Yeah.
I had never had ID, no birth certificate. I've lived my whole life like this.
Yeah.
That's why you say, well, you're driving them. I didn't even have a birth certificate, let alone ID to go and sit for a test. Like, I didn't exist in the real world. No bank account, nothing. So I'm just there with all this illegal money. Everyone's watching me. And it's just like, bro, what am I doing?
The only thing that, the only ID you have is the phone in your pocket, really.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right.
And the number they gave you when you were 15.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, and the new one when I was 18. Yeah, when I first went to jail. Yeah.
And so from there, you have another mind shift. You're clean. You've lived that life, the lavish life. And then all of a sudden, you kind of become this. What was the mind shift? Where you end up now, you're out of jail. You've released some music. You've got a huge following. Countercultural icon, I've heard you described as. Storyteller. And you're telling of a life that, you know, not many of us have heard about, certainly today. What was the shift there? What was the shift in your mind to just go, okay, well, I'm not going to stab anyone when I get out, but I'm also not going to sell any drugs?
All right. So when I got locked up the last time, 2012, my missus at the time was pregnant. So my first son, he was born while I was in jail. It was very different. I'm a dad. Missed out on 5 years of my son's life. Got him when he's 5 years old. I don't know, man, like... During that last sentence, during that last 5 years, which is, that's the longest, I've done 13 years all up. Mm-hmm. 5 is the longest I've done at one time. It just all become, jail become hell.
Mm.
Jail really become hell, and I don't know why. Mm. I was jail. Mm. Jail, I was like furniture in jail. Like, jail was my home. And it become, the first I come in, sweet tooth, after 3 years, into the fourth year, it's like I couldn't bear it.
Mm.
I started looking at everyone in jail as just like, just bad job kicks. Like, I didn't want a bar of it.
Yeah.
I was sick of everything they had to say.
Yeah.
I was sick of everything they do. I was sick of just everything. And I just wanted a different life. And it's weird. Jail started to like really get to my heart and really started to scare me, you know, in a way where, not in like something's going to happen to me, in a way where it's like, I'm scared of being in a cell.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's, maybe like how normal people are.
Yeah. Like how I envision going to any of those jails you just mentioned.
So like, there was that. And then like, I don't know, something happened in my soul that I can't explain. And you know, like, I had religious experiences that are really hard to put into words, and I never really attempt to. And people say, like, what do you mean? Like, it's like I know God, like, you know? And they're like, what do you mean you know God? Explain. What does he sound like? I was like, but you can't say it. You can't say it, you know what I mean? It's just like I went from being a... Because I'm very, very, very... I say this about myself. I'm a very smart person. I don't know how, but, like, I had this ability because I was a raging, angry atheist. And I had this ability to, I swear with you, you leave me alone for 10 minutes and I will talk you out of your God with facts, hard facts. And I had the answer to everything. I could talk a Muslim out of Islam. I could talk a Christian out of Christianity. And it's like, bruh, and I made perfect sense. And I bring tears to people's eyes, you know? And so I went from that to experiencing God, you know what I mean? And seeing the truth. Mm. And after that, it was just like, it softened me a lot. You know what I mean? It softened me a lot and it made me see another person that I can become.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Having said that, that doesn't mean that...
You're not going every Sunday, you know?
No. I've never been to... This is the weird thing, so...
Yeah, it's just your own experience.
Yeah, it's the weird... So, like, I'm religious and I love and follow Jesus, but I don't call myself a Christian.
Yeah.
It sounds weird, but whatever, who cares?
Yeah.
That's the end of that story. But getting out... I was completely confused if what I'm going to do in the world. Mm. I have no work experience, I don't have no life. I got no world experience. Yeah, forget work experience. I don't even know what people do outside.
Yeah.
And I met someone, because I've been rapping in jail.
Yeah.
All right. I've been rapping in jail and boys' homes for a good 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. Back when it wasn't cool to rap in jail. Mm. And I'd met someone along the way who was part of this new up-and-coming emerging Aussie rap scene outside. Mm-hmm. And he'd come in jail once with me at Long Bay. His name's Spinner. He's another rapper. And when I got out, he remembered me and he remembered how good I rapped. And he got in touch with me. And I was seeing his like message request on Facebook. Mm. And I was like, oh, that idiot talking about rap. What the, you know, and I agreed to meet him only because like I had nothing else to do. And he's full out. He showed me the whole rundown of social media. I didn't know what Instagram was.
Yeah.
Nothing. Knew nothing about building a YouTube channel or anything like that. Described to me that there's this big scene and everyone's like real interested. It's up and coming and it's all based around Instagram. Instagram is the heart of all of this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you should make an Instagram app, an Instagram account and make a couple songs and put them on there and put them on YouTube, you'll be famous, you know? Like, you won't be famous, but he said people will love it.
Yeah, you get a following.
That's it. Just went from that. Yep. It wasn't my intention. Yep. I'd done what he said. I'd done it.
Yep.
And it just grew and grew and grew.
And then all of a sudden you're rapping, all of a sudden you're talking, all of a sudden you're telling these stories.
Oh, the first time I talked was, that's when like, the first time I spoke about anything, people went nuts.
You spoke your Stucky.
Oh, Stracky.
Stracky, yeah. That
was half into it, though. Wasn't even at the start. I spoke at the start. I expressed my opinion on something. I don't remember what it was. And I just be completely myself.
Yeah.
I do not even know what I'm going to say before. Mm. I think I should just turn on that. This is just 100% how I've always talked and how everyone I know talks. But I talked and people were like mesmerized by the way I talked. Mm. The way I held myself, the things I say, and I just noticed that I'm this real interesting person.
Yeah.
It's like apparently I'm just this real interesting person. Mm. So I started talking more, and that's it.
And you start telling stories. And
yeah,
you start,
they tell us about this.
And you become the face of this whole thing that a lot of people from, you know, Sydney and other cities now are struggling to explain when they've got the kids speaking pig Latin and they've got the kids wearing a certain dress, you know, and you've kind of articulated that, I guess, as well. You know, become a cultural kind of touch point for Esches, Adelaide's, you know, like that element of inner city living or city living.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden we realize, actually, this guy's written a book.
Yep.
And as we've discussed a lot today, we've had a hell of an interview. Yeah. But there's plenty more stories, you know what I mean, that we didn't get near today. I mean,
no, barely even scratched the surface of what's in the book.
We barely even scratched the surface of the Sydney Siege. You should get in the book. Yeah. Just figure out what went down that sleepy afternoon in Dover Heights.
It was fun.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining us today, Spanion. It's great to meet you, and it's a great read. So, to the listeners out there on the tractor, whether you're in the boat, in the car, get yourself a copy, get the missus one too.